two longtime Sonoma County Shakers join us today. Author, director, and painter Linda Loveland Reed, and architect, playwright, and author H.B. Reed. Hi, I'm Suzanne Lang, and this is A Novel Idea. Linda and Harry each have a slew of talents and accomplishments, and, oh, by the way, they are married and have a great time together, yet are unique in their achievements. H.B. Reed, Harry, has a new novel out called The Concert, and I really wanted to talk with him about his memoir, Nikita Khrushchev Waved at Me. Linda and I will talk about her recently published novel, Something in Stone. We'll close out the show with them giving us a PG-rated version of, well, you'll just have to keep listening to the show to find out. So stay with us. It's A Novel Idea. Linda Loveland Reed is not only a painter, but has been directing plays in the North Bay for some time. She's a driver behind the Redwood Writers, and her first novel was the epic A Touch of Magenta. Her most recent work is set in Sonoma County and Dillon Beach, Something in Stone. Here's my conversation with Linda Loveland Reed. Linda, it's really nice to have you back in the studio again.
Thank you so much. It's great to be here.
Especially because it's with the publication of your second novel called Something in Stone.
Yes, it's been 3 years in coming, and so I'm excited about it.
At the heart of it, this is a book about long-time friends.
That's right. That's what it's about. It's about women who have known each other since grammar school. And like all friendships like that, they are come into contact and then they float away and live their own lives. But there's something about the relationship that stays and that is confirming throughout a lifetime. So this is a story about these women.
And like long-time friends, and as you say, there are times when you're closer and times when you're not, and each person in that kind of a group friendship or relationship seems to have a role, or a role they fall into or get stuck into or put into, and there are secrets that are long held that need to come out and that need to get resolved somehow. And the whole story of the book is how these people interact with each other. So why don't you set up how they come together?
Well, they have known each other, as I said. And on prom night, when they were in high school, one of their group, Annette, walked into the ocean. They didn't talk a lot about all that. Because for one thing, they were very young, they were going off to college, they were living their own lives, and it was a shock, and it was also something, I think, that when you're that age, you may not be really prepared to deal in depth with all of that. So this is 35 years later, and they have come together because they have inherited the beach house from Annette's mother. And they don't know why. And they're going to meet at the beach house and talk about that, what to do. And as you said, we have all these various personalities, some stuck in a role as family. You know, when we're in families, our family sort of sees us in a certain way. We could go off and do millions of things that are totally different. But when we come back to that family, that's sort of who they expect us to be. So you have, you know, Rennie, who's the glue, and, you know, the athlete is Chris, and the actress is Morgan. And they're also, as you said, there's these secrets. Some of the secrets are just things that have happened to these women as they went out to live their lives. And we don't always share everything. And some of them are secrets that had to do with their childhood and things that happened. So, yeah, this all comes out.
And the book is told in such a way where you do have different voices coming through, different perspectives of the different characters, and episodes, chapters that are, some are set at, it's set in different points of time. So the story is told in a temporal sense, in a nonlinear way. And so what were the challenges to you as a writer to pull it together that way? And what made you decide to make those choices?
Well, I decided to write the book because it's came out of a weekend that I spent with my own friends from Hillsburg. And we went away for a weekend together, and I was amazed at all of the things that came out. And it also struck me how different we all were, and how different all these different experiences that people have in their lives, they don't always talk about. So in doing this book, the biggest challenge I had was that I didn't have one protagonist. I wanted to write it with all five of the women having a voice. And, you know, that can be a little dicey. And so I hope that I pulled it off. I hope that each woman was, you know, unique enough and interesting enough that the reader was okay to have these five women to follow. So that was my biggest challenge. And also, I'm really, really always sensitive about flashbacks. I think flashbacks have to be handled really well. If there's too much of it, it can really bog your story down. So you have to find the right balance for that.
And you did. That it wasn't confusing, and the characters really did each have their own personality, and the way they related to one another, it rang true. And the book is set, for the most part, locally, and with Dillon Beach being one of the settings, and they all went to high school together in Healdsburg. And so I wondered, you just said that your own reunion of sorts kind of helped trigger this, and I wondered how much of this is your story, your setting, and why you chose those locations.
Well, I had written, my first book was an historical novel, in that I really moved around a lot, Singapore, and it was about in the Gold Country in Sonoma County, and it was in England and so on. And I loved that. I loved the research. I'm have my BA in history and in art history, and so that was just a natural for me. And in a way, I missed that, but I wanted to try to get into some of the history of Sonoma County and talk about the different communities. And so that was fun, too, exploring and kind of bringing out a few tidbits that maybe people had forgotten or did never know about the area.
Well, I will confess that I am along. I lived for many, many years out at Dillon Beach and in one of the cottages, and that is a lot of activity happens there. And I was put right there, and how true it is about that place that people come together, spend weekends, have, you know, where lots of different things go on, and for teenagers who, and these women were teenagers when they first started going out there, a lot of formative experiences. Yeah.
Yes, and I had spent my husband and I had gone out and spent some time in one of the homes out, vacation homes out there, and it was charming, absolutely charming, and I think I just was so taken with that house and with that location and everything that I thought, what a nice place to set a book, and it gives you a little bit of distance when you're writing a book, this is set in 1998, and when you're writing a book in basically modern times, you have to be aware of cell phones and of this constant communication. It cuts the drama down, and so you need to find ways to work that all out and work it all in. And either, you know, in my case, of course, cell phones weren't working very well out in Dillon Beach. They were just barely, you know, we were just catching on to all that. So that worked out very well for the book.
The women in the story, when they were girls, they played with runes, and that is also a device you use. It's a theme in the book. And so why don't you tell our listeners a little bit, for those who don't know what runes are, about runes, and I'm curious as to why you used that in the storytelling.
Yes, well, I used it in the storytelling because when I went with my own friends, and we spent our weekend, someone brought along the runes game. What it is an ancient Viking, use the word game, and it's R-U-N-E. And it's a lot of very small tiles that have glyphs drawn on them. And each tile has a specific glyph. And so they're in a bag. And the idea is that you touch the bag on the outside so that it gets all your energy. Then you reach your hand inside. And then you want to let the rune choose you. So you kind of finger around until the rune chooses you and you pull it out. And then there's a book. And the rune will have a saying that will talk about the rune that you've pulled out. And it really isn't telling the future. It's getting you to pull out of yourself what is happening and how you would talk about that particular thing. It might be separation. It might be fertility. You know, it's that kind of thing that can pull things out. So that's what got me thinking about it.
And the element of the runes in the story add a little punch to the narrative. And though I wouldn't call the book a mystery, at its heart, there kind of is a mystery. And the element of the runes adds another dimension to that is kind of fun for the reader.
Yes, I was really surprised when we got together and we did the runes as a group, how much it did contribute to pulling out feelings. And that's really what I wanted the runes to do in the book. And of course, I can't talk about what happens with all of that in the book. But yes, there definitely is a mystery. And I think that the book, even though it has a lot of fun and a lot of interest as these women talk about all kinds of things, whether it be menopause or men or sex or politics or whatever it is. But I think that it also has, in the end, I hope, a serious side to it, and that you will feel, or the reader will feel, that their time was well spent.
Well, just the relationship of the characters to one another is very much like relationships are evolving. There's transformations involved, and the characters one is retired, parents, non-parents. One of the characters is running for office, and one is a psychologist. And yet they still are evolving both emotionally and in their friendships. And there's some sadness and sorrow in the book, too, as we live our lives and face those things. And it seems like it's very important to you as a writer to explore those issues of life and loss and friendship and betrayal.
Well, it seems that way with me. I've written two books now, and once you write two books, you start to get a sense about what you are as a writer. when you first start out, you're just writing the book. When you decide what you're going to write about that second time, because each time you're deciding, how am I going to spend my next 2 or 3 years? Hopefully this next book, I will be able to get it out within a couple of years, because as you learn, as you grow in your knowledge about writing and also about just the book industry itself, you're really able to get your books out a little quicker than that first one. It took me 5 years, and this second one was 3 years, although I was not writing on the book the whole time. I could have done it sooner. But I think what I discovered is that I seem to need to write about something that touches me personally. While these are not exactly biographical, and I want to make that really clear because of all of my friends in Healdsburg, I want them to speak to me for the rest of my life, that these are stories. But still, it touches me personally. And I think the thing that was my biggest thing that happened to me personally is when I was a child, when I was 2. And my mother took me somewhere and just didn't come back. I had a wonderful, wonderful life. My father remarried a wonderful woman, and she was my mother. So I'm very, very fortunate, much more fortunate than many people who may have gone through something like that. But these monumental things that occur in our lives, whether we remember them or not, they are part of us. And I really realized that when I began to write my stories, because it seems like I write to some degree. Like I say, it's not exact, but there is something in there that resonates with me.
It seems like it would be hard or almost impossible for any writer to not have shards of themselves coming out in the book. Maybe an author might deny that, but I don't believe it can be true.
It's really better when it is, because we talk, writers talk about having what you've written, does it have truth in it? And it can be a story that you totally made up, but nevertheless, there's truth in it. If in some way, some place in there, it touches you. So, yeah, very true.
And Linda, I want you to talk a little bit about the publication of the book and how readers can get it. Now, it is available on Amazon.com.
Correct,
yes.
Correct. And Kindle.
And Kindle.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So it's a good way to find the book.
Yes.
And what is your next? Are you working on something else right now?
Right now, I'm just writing some short stories and some poetry and things like that. I'm kind of breathing a little bit. And also, I'm having the fun right now of sort of casting around for what is that next book going to be? Where am I going to spend my next couple of years? And who is going to come into my life and character-wise? And what kinds of things am I going to be writing about, thinking about, building on? So it's a fun time to do that. And I have a few ideas, but nothing's, come right out yet. So,
well, when you were writing something in stone with its cast of female characters that are involved in a friendship, I imagine that you were feeling their presence in your life.
You really do. It was my husband, Harry, who said to me, why don't you write a novel? And that was when I had just finished Sonoma State University in 1999. And I just said no, because it felt like it would be too much of a solitary kind of activity for me. I've direct theater, and I'm more of a social, I guess, a person. But anyway, he kind of kept suggesting this, and I finally said, okay, look, this is it. Here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to write a trash novel, and I'm going to have it done in 3 months. None of this, long time. Well, 5 years later, I published Touch of Magenta. So what happened is I discovered that it isn't solitary. It isn't solitary because you have all these characters. And I know it's a real cliche to say this, but, you know, you are riding along. And as you ride along, things start to happen that you didn't know were going to happen. And characters say things that you didn't think they'd say. And all of a sudden, the story takes a turn. And I really, truly happens. And people who want to write, what I say to them is start writing and write 2 pages in total concentration, and I tell you that you will find that this can happen for you.
And you alluded to the fact, Linda, that you are a person of many, you have your fingers in many activities and many art forms, and you are a painter as well. And it seems like painting would be a solitary activity. And did you take up painting around the same time you took up writing?
No, I actually took up painting first. And painting as well as writing, both of these things were things that I did not think could belong to me. I did not feel or think that I could be in that world. Oh, I could look at paintings. I love art. And as I said, I have a BA in art history. I love it. I love to look at it. I love to be around it. I even worked at the DeRosa Preserve for 6 months just so I could be in the room with that art. And so when I started to paint and when I started to write, it was astounding to me. I'd always was a whole lifetime of stick figures and an inability to feel that I was anywhere near an artist. In writing, I'm a little bit dyslexic, and I'm not the greatest speller, and I always did well in school, but I worked at it. And so, again, I think I just so cherish this, and I also very much want people to know that, you know, they'll say to me, oh my gosh, I could never paint like that. Oh, I could never write like that. And I'm just here to tell you, it's just not true at all. I mean, it's all about passion. That's all you have to have is the passion to do something, and you can do it.
And I think many of our listeners will know that you have been involved with the Redwood Writers for a long time, and that is an organization that encourages and supports people to just do it.
Oh, absolutely. I was writing Touch of Magenta, and I was writing in a vacuum. I'm so fortunate to have Harry, my husband, who also writes and who also is an architect and is interested in art and who has absolutely been my life mentor. I mean, anything that I wanted to do, he's always been there to say, yes, you know, do it, and will even help me or guide me. And I think that having that has been absolutely important. In each phase of your life, it's interesting. You know, I had a time when, of course, I was raising my children. I was a single mother. I had 3 children. I started a business, my children came in the business with me, so it's a family business. And I was pretty dedicated to that. I mean, I really admire women who are holding lots of balls in the air, and I know how difficult it is. And I think you just need to keep your eye somewhere on that, because that's a passion. That's a passion to raise your children. It's a passion to work and to have a career that you, I don't care what that career is, that you want to do a good job at it. Those are all passions. But there are these other passions in your life that you just want to keep your eye on those. And when it opens up and when that time comes for you to be able to go after those, that you do it.
It does seem like you are somebody who does take off. You know, when you want to do something, you do it. And I admire that, and I love how generous you are with others, encouraging people to do what you have done.
Well, thank you. Maybe that's why I get involved as I do as a volunteer, because I really do feel it's so important for people to believe in themselves and to know that they have the capability. They only just need to want to do it, and that it's there. It's all there.
I want to end on a note of something in stone, a book about friendship and longevity and life and loyalties. So thank you for coming in today and talking to us about it.
Thank you so much for having me.
You're listening to KRCB's A Novel Idea, and that was my conversation with Linda Loveland Reed. She'll be back later in the broadcast for a conversation with her husband and collaborator, Harry. So stay with us.
You're not wrong and I'm not right. We can't read the truth in black and white. Oh, does it have to be so cut and dry? We act like there's so much to lose just by walking in each other's shoes. Oh, would it really hurt us if we tried? 'Cause the real story lies between your heart and mine. It's not
You're listening to KRCB's A Novel Idea. I'd not been familiar with the work of H.B. Reed and dove into reading his fiction, The Connected, A Novel in the Future, The Year of the Tiger, and his most recent, The Concert, The Diary of Count Federico Alfieri. And I also read his enchanting memoir, Nikita Khrushchev Waved at Me, Encounters with Fame. His work is sweet and funny with a self-effacing humor that won me over. Here is my conversation with a somewhat raspy H.B. Reed.
Your memoir, it is called Nikita Khrushchev Waved to Me, Encounters with Fame. It was just a great setup for a memoir to use your encounters with people the reader knows about as kind of the galvanizing piece of the work. So why don't you talk a little bit about how that came to you?
I think it really came through Linda because we made a list of all the famous people I just bumped into. I've not been in the State Department or I'm not a famous person in any way. But for crazy reasons, I would run into various people. So we made a list of it, and it turned out to be about 24, 26 people that were really rather well known. And I was between books, and so she suggested, well, why don't you write a memoir on it? And I found that very congenial. It was a pleasant thing to do. And what I really enjoyed the most of it was the voice of the person in that book. And it's kind of like a catcher in the rye kind of voice, someone growing up. I was able to do quite a bit of that. And it amused me to write it. And then when I got to talk about other people, generally there was something amusing about it. People associate with me with being a funny writer, and I've been compared with David Sedaris and so forth. I don't try to do that. It just, things come to me in a very funny way. And so I really, really enjoyed writing the book. It was fun.
Well, in your memoir, Nikita Khrushchev Waved to Me, that voice that does span time. And I think the H.B. Reed represented in your memoir is somebody who, you know, maybe doesn't always work as hard as he could.
Right. Maybe, I'm very lazy.
And maybe there was an opportunity that you didn't quite, make, but proceed through life kind of enjoying it anyway. And that's where I found the charm of the book.
Yeah, I think I'm really conscious of the fact that I have a life, and I don't want to commit it to something that isn't enjoyable. And so in the memoir, there were a number of opportunities that a less lazy man than I really would have jumped at. And I've always been kind of suspicious. I see a kind of like an annunciation scene by Cimabue, Mary sitting there minding her own business. And I think it's Gabriel comes down with a lily and tells her, oh, by the way. And I've been that way my whole life. Everybody is, often people present me with lilies, and my eyes squint down like the early Sienese painters did. And I'm not so sure. I'm a little suspicious. So I've managed to miss a lot of wonderful things in my life. So.
You have a story in here about being at a party on Maya Angelou's houseboat in Sausalito.
And P5, yeah.
I'm wondering if you could just maybe recapitulate some of that. And you weren't friends with her, but we're at a party, is my understanding. But it gave a side of her that maybe we don't see or are aware of or know about as well. So why don't you talk a little bit about that?
It's a little bit different. I wouldn't say I wasn't friends with her, because at Gate 5 in Sausalito, everybody's friendly with everybody. She was not the Angelou that we kind of got to know. I think she'd had kind of a wildish sort of life as a younger woman, and a very attractive woman. And she was still living somewhat wildly, I'd say, in Gate 5. But so was everybody else living wildly. And kind of talking about the voice that we were talking about, I'm not a great risk taker. So, but I kind of hang around and so forth, and I had the opportunity to go. And she was just busy. She had exotic scarves wrapped around her and dancing away, and very, very vivacious kind of thing going on. And I don't know if you remember from the story, somebody came in with a gun, and everybody jumped on him, or a lot of the men jumped on him. It's kind of a testosterone kind of thing. And I was just astounded, because he was down on the floor with his mouth open, and a rather rude woman who was a Gate Fiver from way back took a pitcher of water and started pouring it down his throat. And I was Jack Armstrong or Superman at that point, and I had to rip all the men off. They were all happy drinking wine, so they weren't hard to get off the man, but I was fighting here and there. And he finally got up, and he was really, really angry. And he reached over, and there was a flashlight standing there on a counter next to me. He took that flashlight and beat me over the head with it. And I mean, I really had kind of saved his life. So it was an irony. But she, I can't say, I think I've described her as well as I was an acquaintance of her at the time.
Yeah, it is a slice of her life that we don't always think of her quite that way.
No,
and
no,
so
no.
I thought that was...
I think she was pretty wild when she was young.
And you were this unwitting victim in the whole thing.
Yeah.
And
I think
that
happens in the memoir and other places too.
And some just missed opportunities and funny little vignettes, but also you are an architect or have been practicing as an architect in your life, among many other things, and there are some stories in the book that center around that and you were a young man working at Taliesin and with Frank Lloyd Wright.
Yeah.
And I think that you probably gave a very apt description of life with Frank Lloyd Wright. And I wonder if you could talk a little bit about that experience that you had there and how it influenced you in your life.
I was by far the youngest person there. I was, I think, 19 when I came out. I'd been in the Navy, so I'd had some experience, but a lot of older GIs were coming back. And if we remember, I'm kind of a lazy person. There were a lot of really dedicated people, self-confident, argumentative people there and so forth. So it was quite a mix of things. For some reason or other, Mrs. Wright took a liking to me. And I had no real manual skills. My father had never fixed a plumbing in his life or electric things. And so I guess they found a job for me was to select records that would be played down in the apprentices' dining rooms and so forth. And I didn't put this in the book, but I was getting hit on a lot. I was really kind of pretty. And it was kind of a male situation there and a number of people, men who were interested in men. And I kind of think they may have taken me up into their house to live. I'm not sure. There's no way for me to know. Or maybe I was just simply incompetent. They just wanted to keep me someplace else.
The Wrights, you're talking about, you
Mr.
got
and Mrs. Wright, yeah.
got to live in yeah. the Wrights' house.
And I remember when I told the story, and I think this is a truth, that I think he is the finest creative person America has developed yet, without question in my mind. And yet I'm not an aficionado. I don't design like him. But he just was really a remarkable man. And he believed it, too. So there were two of us, at least, that thought he was pretty great and so forth. And so I remember saying in that particular chapter, saying this about him, that he was the finest man who ever, that America's yet produced in the arts. And yet the experience overwhelmed me. I was too young, and I didn't mind all the people hitting on me and all that stuff, but it was just, I just wasn't prepared for that life. It was a good life, I guess, but I couldn't do it. And so after 3 months, I decided that I would do better if I went out and got some experience, which I did, but before that, not stay there any longer, that it probably wasn't useful to me. So I remember climbing up a ladder, and he was up, his house was always burning down and all this kind of stuff. And I remember climbing up a ladder to a roof that he was having re-roofed at Taliesin proper, not Hillside where the apprentices live. And he's up there pointing with his cane as if these guys had never shingled a roof before. You know, it was like each shingle was going to be a specially right placed shingle or something like that. And he's very occupied with it. And I remember I climbed up this ladder, and I was standing on the edge of a gutter, and I just fell apart. I just couldn't handle it and so forth, and I began to cry. And I said, I tried to explain to him why I felt I couldn't stay there. That's not a small thing with Mr. Wright. I don't care who decides not to stay there. That is not a small thing with him. And so he just turned his back from me and never said a word. And I remember at the end of that chapter saying that the greatest creative person that America's ever known turned his back on me and wouldn't say another word. I like the chapter for that. It had a kind of a nice shape to it. So, by the way, Mrs. Wright was really a very, very nice person. They were okay people.
And you made the decision to leave there.
Yeah.
And that brings up another issue that is kind of threaded through the book. And I will say your father's maybe tolerance, maybe
yeah.
reluctant acceptance that you weren't necessarily going to follow the family way or that you had your own thing about you. But that talk a little bit about your dad.
Interesting enough, I did the memoir because we had a list of names, and Linda said, why don't you write a memoir? And I didn't know what the internal arc was, and I chose something that wasn't arc-like. I mean, nothing terrible happened to me at the end of the last person I wrote about. But what happened, I discovered that I had a pretty nice father. Even now, it's a little hard to talk about it because he just accepted everything I did And when I left Taliesin, I was too good to go to school then. Anybody went to Taliesin, you know, shouldn't be in school. And so I wanted to work. And I was 19 years old, and everybody was coming back from the war. And how to get a job at the end of 19, at the age of 19. And my dad was really disappointed. He was a Yale man, and my brother went to Yale. My grandfather went to Yale, nephews, everybody went to Yale. And we didn't live too far from New Haven, and people from Yale were getting in touch with me to come to school there. And I didn't want to do that. And so I promised him that if he would, that I'd work for a year and then go to college. I didn't say Yale. And I really felt that there was an honorable thing about that, that I wouldn't give up. And but he didn't know. I mean, lots of kids say, I'm just going to do this for a little while, and they never go back to school. And he really, really thought a great deal about education. And he accepted it. I don't know whether provisionally or not, but he did. And he, within a day or two, he'd gotten me a job. And there were a bunch of things. He sent me to Andover, which is a remarkably good Eastern school that turn out people so they can go to Yale and all that kind of stuff. And I'd gotten an award by Yale for being apparently a remarkable person. I couldn't have given him a greater gift. And I remember we were sitting outside the chapel after the ceremonies, and I had the gall to tell him it didn't mean anything to me.
And you do address that in the book. And I could tell it's an emotional thing even for you now. And you do address that in the book, that the years of your living have brought a... You're no longer 19 years old.
Yeah. And anyway, so I discovered how much I loved the man writing that book, so that was good.
Isn't that sometimes why people write memoir, to maybe examine their life in a different way? And yours is, it's nonlinear. It is galvanized around these episodes or encounters, yet the thread of who you are and who your family is did come out in the book.
And
lots of other people are mentioned in the book, and I'm going to encourage our readers to pick it up. But first, we need to tell them how to do that. Now, we've also mentioned that your authorship of the books is under H.B. Reed, and how can they get their hands on this book?
The way I would prefer it is if they emailed hbreed100@gmail.com, and I'd just send them the book and send them an invoice. I think it's $12, something like that. Or they can go to, and if they didn't pay me, that's okay, because it's funny. I didn't write the book as a profit enterprise. But anyway, if they paid me, that'd be great too. Or they can just go to Amazon, and they go to Amazon and then just H.B. Reed.
Let's talk about your latest book, The Concert, The Diary of Count Federico Alfieri. Yeah. It's a historical novel, yet it's not set in the past, or didn't feel like it was set in the past, but it is steeped in kind of a pastness.
It's a historical fiction, and it's based upon a real life happening, which was in 1990 around St. Patrick's Day in Boston, a small museum, Isabella Stewart Gardner Museum, was robbed in just the most ham-handed way. It was really silly. They might as well not have had any guards at all. And taken from it was were two Rembrandts, a couple of Manets, Degas, and so forth, and a Vermeer. And the Vermeer, there are only about 34 of them that he ever painted. Well, that was 23 years ago, and it's never been returned. And the museum sends out into the community things like, look, if you're not going to return the painting, it's called, the painting was the concert, please take good care of it and keep it at this temperature and this moisture content and so forth. That just knocked me over. It really did. It was like their own kids in a kidnapping and so forth. So I wrote a short story, and I invented a Count Alfieri, Federigo Alfieri, who was a man who was involved in trying to save this book. And I can't. It's really hard to talk about this book because the story is in it, and I don't want to hurt the story. But I would say the theft of the book is real, but the story is about a man. And maybe this is autobiographical, except that he's enormously wealthy in the book. But he's kind of lazy, too. And he's a yachtsman. He grew up with three aunts who spoiled him in various places. Never had to work. He's the head of a holding company because his family started out in the 15th century baking bread for the Medici family and so forth. So he just hasn't thought about money. In fact, he says he doesn't own anything, because he doesn't need to. And he acquires this villa in Tuscany, just north of Florence. And there are about 14 people working there. And gradually, they take over his life with their concerns and so forth. Before, he had nothing he had to worry about. He just go to a board meeting once a year or something like that. And now he's had close romances, but he's never had really close relationships. And all of a sudden, this family becomes very, very close to him.
And he likes that. He likes
Yeah, he learns to like it. Yeah, it becomes very valuable to him, as a matter of fact. And so, without getting too much into the painting itself, it turns out, fate would have it, that if anybody's going to save that painting, it's going to be he. And we'll just leave that there. But it really ruins a life. It's just a wonderful life. It gets involved with gangsters and all kinds of stuff, and what was so beautiful and happy on that in that villa no longer is. Anyway, in the course of whatever happens about that painting, there's one person in the villa who manages to solve that problem for him. I really can't say more because it kind of talks the story away, but I might say about the book that it began as a short story, what I wrote maybe 5 or 6 years ago, about 4,300 words. And when I decided to see if it would go as a short novel, I got it up to about 16,000 words. And I had enough to go that I went even farther, and I finally got it up to a small novel size, about 70-plus thousand words. To do that, I had to bring in various other things. So I let the Count have a family that were fascists during Mussolini's time, and that kind of guilt that the Italians either feel or ought to feel about what happened there kind of is threaded through the book and made the book quite interesting to me. And then as he gets involved in trying to save that painting, he goes through, he learns about various people who have forged paintings, because maybe if he's trying to save a painting, maybe it isn't worth saving because maybe it isn't even the real painting. Because I think someone in the book says maybe 50% of the Metropolitan's paintings are not whom the Metropolitan thinks did it. So I tried to do that without becoming too preachy or didactic and just kind of slip it into the mystery of the book. And people who have read it say they kind of feel rewarded. I mean, it gets down to how Vermeer mulled his paints, and how lapis lazuli was extremely expensive, and people didn't use it except in various careful ways, and things of that, how 17th century Dutch art was being performed. So that was fun to do. I like that.
And it was fun to read. It's a good read, and the Count, though he did not like being called the Count, yeah, he is a character I think all readers will come to have a great deal of affection, yeah, for. So, again, you can get these books under the author's name of H.B. Reed. You can Google that. You can go to Amazon or write directly to the author himself, Harry Reid, at hbreid100 at gmail.com.
Yeah.
Very good, and thank you. Your latest book is The Concert, The Diary of Count Federico Alfieri. Thanks a lot for coming in, Harry.
You're welcome.
Linda and Harry are married spouses, and I thought it'd be fun to have them in the studio together.
You two have been a real force in Sonoma County, I think, with theater, the arts. Now you're both writing, and tell me, how do you do it as a couple? Do you inspire one another and encourage one another? And you seem to have a really good time together. So I'm just going to throw that out there.
Well, I'm going to start because Harry really was, when you say encourage each other, I loved art but wasn't really painting per se. And after 10 years of being a voyeur and a very active one, Harry bought me for Christmas a set of paints, and he's an architect and an artist, and so he set them up and got the water and put the canvas up in front of me and the brushes, and then walked away. And oh my gosh, I was, of course, immediately aware of how hugely I could fail, as we all are when we take on something new that has a blank canvas. But I painted a pretty awful painting. But from then on, I just kind of kept doing it and loved doing it. So it's always kind of been that way, in that when I started directing theater, I had been watching Harry's playwright, and so we had directors who were directing his plays, and I would sit in the theater of long hours and watch all this. And I thought to myself, you know, I think I'd like to do that. But I didn't say anything, and I started reading books on playwriting. Harold Clurman was my hero. And then one day I said to Harry, I think I would like to direct. And 3 days later, he had a play for me to direct in Sonoma. So it's kind of been that way. It was the same thing with writing. When I started writing, he said, he was the one that said, why don't you write a novel? So,
After a couple of my plays were done, it was pretty evident that Linda was going to direct anything I ever did after that. Not just theater. I'm talking about my entire life. Okay. So that was an ipso facto kind of a priori kind of thing. And we had two ways of working together in the theater. When she was directing plays, she directed a number of plays other than mine. I would do the sets for her. And if you remember, I was talking about Cimabue and that look that Mary gets when the angel comes down. Well, I would come up with a set idea for her. And Christ, I'd get that same look at me, you know, like, you know, I don't think this is really going to work. And so I learned to work with her then by saying, well, you're right. You know, that probably wouldn't work. And of course then, well, maybe it would work. And that's so we'd kind of do this kind of negotiation back and forth. And that's been a lot of fun, really. And that's probably the way we work our life anyway. But on the other hand, when it came to her directing my theater, actors love to talk to the source. You know, what did you mean when you wrote this? And of course, it's just terrible for a director because they bypass the director. And so I got one read of the play that I could read to the actors and allegedly say, answer any of their questions. But that was it. And it was so dear because we live in a two-story house, and I'd be kind of like a Winnie the Pooh character sitting up on top of the steps listening to her direct my plays down below, and I could not say a word. So,
well, you know, I have to say that in a new play, you often workshop it, you talk about it. The director is going to talk a lot to the author, to the playwright. The thing of it is, with us, we've already done that. We've been doing it for, you know, the whole time he's writing a play. We're talking about the characters. We know them intimately. I know the play intimately. So by the time it's time to put it up, and Harry gets, you know, one good visit with the actors and everybody's set, then I sort of want to take off after that. Because for one thing, the playwright often doesn't really realize all the wonderful nuances that they've actually produced. And now it's the director and the actor's job, you know, to carry that through. So I would say that when I'm directing one of Harry's plays, it's pretty dicey. It's pretty dicey. And we managed to make it through. And I always say, I'm not going to do it again. And then as soon as he does a play, he asks me to do it. And, you know, of course, we're on the merry-go-round again.
An interesting thing about art, taking that a different step, she is able, I think it's perhaps her greatest strength is actually her painting. She is able to do things with color almost the way the Impressionists did, but she's not an Impressionistic painter, but just squirting out of the tube. I guess the way Pollock worked earlier. She's full of color in her hands and all over. And I'm kind of a delicate kind of a painter and more precise painter and sketcher and so forth. And I have tried to paint like Linda. I have tried so hard to paint like Linda, and I cannot do it.
You both have just released a book, the concert, Harry's book, and Something in Stone, Linda's book. And what was that like, maybe being at the same stage of getting the book ready for production at the publication at the same time?
Well, it's the last, very last part of a book is pretty intense, because your editor is reading it and you're reading it and you're trying to get all the errors out of it. So there's a lot of intensity in that last part. I know one day, many days actually, we were both sitting in bed and I was working on his book and he was working on mine. So it's like scratch, scratch, scratch. Oh, yeah? Scratch, scratch, scratch.
One of the total joys I have in life is we don't get up early in the morning. We have our breakfast and are in bed still together. And there's a point where she is so delicious that I put my nose up against her for, say, a half hour. This is okay when she's on a Kindle or something like that. But as soon as she gets on one of my things, I can hear the graphite. I mean, here I'm in cloud nine. I mean, it's just so wonderful there. And I can just hear this graphite going scritch, scritch, scritch all the way down there. So I have to object to that, and she gives up on that sort of thing.
That was G-rated. That was G-rated. Thank you for keeping it that way. Well, now that we've had a little slice of your morning life, I wish you both well and continued success in literary and theater career. And I want to say, please continue bringing us all that you do here.
Linda Loveland Reed and H.B. Reed have been my guests. Thank you for listening. We've had production assistance from Sean Knight. Rosemary Manchester is off with family and will return next month. You can subscribe to our podcast and listen.